Coming Friday, April 8th, and Saturday, April 9th, Issues Etc. 24. It's a live 24-hour Bible study from 4 in the afternoon Central Time on April 8th through 4 in the afternoon Central on April 9th. Issues Etc. 24. Friday, April 8th, and Saturday, April 9th. Listen live at issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're coming to you live this Friday afternoon. It's the 1st of April. It was a big story back in September of 2010. A pastor down in Florida threatening to burn the Quran. He almost did, and then, wow, even the president's administration intervened, and it was an international story. Did you know, I didn't, that he actually did burn the Quran about a week ago after a mock trial of the book? Why didn't we read about this? What does it say about the media? Joining us to talk about media coverage of that story and several others, Molly Ziegler-Hemingway. She's editor and writer in Washington, D.C., and a contributor to GetReligion.org. Molly, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me here.
How did I miss this story about the Florida pastor, the same guy, I recognize him from the picture, who didn't burn a Quran, then he did burn a Quran?
You know, it's amazing because it was literally the biggest story of last year. It was part of what religion news writers claimed was the biggest religion story of last year, was this a decision to burn a Quran, which didn't even happen. And yet then when it actually did happen, it received almost no coverage. There were basically two original news reports, one from agency France Press and one from Religion News Service. And other than that, I didn't see anything. And I'm not even complaining because actually the original coverage was ridiculous. It in no way deserved to be this media firestorm that it ended up being. But, you know, back in the fall, every single person in America, it seemed like, had weighed in on whether it was wise or not wise to burn this Quran. And then when it actually happens, it barely made the news. It's just fascinating.
Is it just that this particular guy, this Florida pastor's 15 minutes of fame had run out, and that's just the way it works in a 24-hour news cycle?
Well, no. It needs to be said that the Japan tsunami, the, you know, Middle East, flaring up. These things all happened at the same time as the Japan earthquake and tsunami, I should say. They happened at the same time as this burning happened. So it is partly that there were many more important news stories happening at the time of the actual burning. But it says something about the way we can get whipped up into frenzies, about the way the media controls what we think of as news and what we don't think of news. And just by way of example, it is true that even the threat of burning resulted in violence and killing in certain Muslim countries back in the fall. But just today, there was a horrible incident in Afghanistan where a mob of Afghanis left a mosque and immediately went to the UN building, laid siege to it, and killed something like 12 people in response to this Quran burning. So it does deserve more coverage than it has received. And coverage of how in any way people think this is an appropriate response needs to happen. I noticed that the first New York Times story about it basically put the blame on Terry Jones, this man who had overseen the burning of this Quran, as if he was somehow responsible for the murders of these people. And that kind of approach to a news story, I think, is actually kind of bigoted, as if we expect nothing more of Afghanis or nothing more of Muslims than to riot like animals or something. I mean, it's very bizarre way to cover the story, as if Jones is actually responsible for anything more than just, you know, doing something that I think we'd all agree is stupid.
What does it say to you about what makes for a major story? I'm not talking about tsunami. I'm not talking about nuclear threat in Japan. Those are obviously major stories. But at other times, what makes for a major story?
Well, I mean, there's some general guides. Obviously, anything fresh, any new angle, anytime someone, if it bleeds, it leads. There are things that people are interested in reading about, and NewsSense should be aware of that and cater to that. What I'm concerned about is more when people are artificially whipping a story into something more. I mean, in a way, had that initial report never happened, had people not paid so much attention to what this Yahoo down in Florida was doing, there might be less bloodshed. Not that I think that we should be confused about who is responsible. But you know, this is a prime way of it's a way of covering the global conflict in a way that makes us feel better, I think, about ourselves. Who cannot be opposed to the burning of a Quran? And it's something that we can all be unified about. Whereas usually stories about the conflict between the Western world, you know, Judeo-Christian background and the Muslim background, they're so much more complicated. They're so much more worrisome. They require so much more detail. But this is a kind of story where everyone, literally everyone, you know, who was a newsmaker back in the fall, the early fall, weighed in on this because it was very easy to weigh in.
You've also written about some coverage of maybe this is a cultural shift. It's hard to tell, but how funerals, and in particular, funeral eulogies, seem to be changing. What's the story here?
Yeah, I love the idea for this story. It was in the Wall Street Journal this week. It's called The Last Laugh, and it's about how there's supposedly this trend of eulogies becoming more funny, you know, using humor more, and having more and more people speak up at a funeral. And this may or may not be true. I mean, as a Lutheran, this is not something we do. We treat funerals like a worship service, pretty much like any other worship service. But, you know, maybe it is true. But the story, it used some really good anecdotes of people being funny and humorous in their eulogies. But it didn't really substantiate the claim, in my view, that it was a growing trend. I mean, I have, you know, I witnessed at my non-Lutheran grandmother's funeral decades ago an attempt at humor. And so I'm not entirely sure if it's new or not. But it was still a very interesting topic for a story.
And, I mean, for someone who, from the, I guess in my case then, because we both share the same Lutheran confession, the inside looking out, what do you think the press needs to understand in particular about Christian funerals if they're going to cover how funeral rite, funeral practice is changing?
Yeah, well, it's something that's important to see. You know, funerals are very somber occasions. Doesn't mean they can't also be joyful for a wide variety of reasons. They're somber worship services where the focus would be on Christ and what Christ has accomplished for that baptized Christian. And the more secular mindset about death is something more about, you know, maybe having a little bit more fun with it or not taking it as seriously. And it's just going to be a totally different mindset. So there's a lot to cover if you're going to cover a funeral, if you're going to cover changes in funeral eulogies. And there really is a dramatic difference between, say, a Christian funeral and a Jewish funeral or either of those funerals and a secular funeral. And even within Christendom, there can be some pretty dramatic differences between funerals, which you can witness simply by attending any two funerals of different confessions.
Finally, you've also noticed some coverage of, and you say this isn't a new story, the Miami Archdiocese and some television ads about penance and coming to confession. What's the story?
Yeah, it was interesting. I noticed from someone I followed on Twitter that there was a Miami CBS, you know, local news story about how the Roman Catholic Archdiocese there had launched a television campaign about confession. And it was a nice little simple story. I mean, it could have been much, much more thorough. But it was interesting to see because actually confession, sacrament of penance, you know, different churches call the rite different things. You know, it's a very, very important thing in the life of the church, a very important thing in the life of the Christian, or, you know, many Christians, particularly during this time, this season that we're in, which is Lent. And yet it never gets covered. You know, what gets covered is if you do a Lenten series on how to improve your sex life or something like that. And yet, what is more a more realistic portrayal of what a Christian goes through than the way that the church or the pastor or whatnot might encourage a parishioner to go to confession? So it was interesting to see, and it was something that, you know, I think other reporters can also see what's happening in their area, how their churches are approaching the Lenten season, particularly as it relates to an increased emphasis on confession.
So your take on this is not so much that the coverage, such as it was wrong or inaccurate or incomplete, but just that this is a perennial, we may even say, multi-millennial issue for Christians who are in the know on this thing.
This is breaking news from 2,000 years ago. People go to confession. No, I mean, you can see why this is not the type of story that's going to get a lot of coverage. The church has literally been doing this for thousands of years. But there are new, and there are new ways that the church handles how they communicate that to parishioners and whatnot. And a good religion reporter will be tuned into that, as opposed to just rewarding that church that tries, like, the craziest new idea in order to get media coverage. Now, again, when you think of just the number of Catholics in this country, the number of other people like Lutherans or Anglicans or others who are being told by their pastors or through their church communications that they should be making sure they get to confession this season, now, that's a much larger number than any sort of fad of the moment that's happening, you know, throughout the rest of the church or in other church bodies. So it's very important that a good religion reporter be tuned into this. And, you know, it's actually a very dramatic story. Anyone who's gone to confession knows it's one of the more dramatic things a penitent can do. It is absolutely terrifying to go in and name your sins, and it's, you know, very, you know, it's also quite something to go through to be told that you're absolved of those sins. A good religion reporter can actually convey the drama there in a way that would be interesting, I think, to a larger audience.
Well, let's take a break right there when we come back. There has been other coverage, and I wonder how well Molly thinks the media has done its job in covering what, shall we say, alternative ways of preparing for confession. We heard about the Confession iPhone app, which turned out not so much to be a Confession iPhone app, but a Preparation for Confession iPhone app. We'll see what she thinks about that coverage on the other side of the break. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. It's Friday, the 1st of April. Are you looking for a Christ-centered, cross-focused church? Check out the Find a Church page at our website, issuesetc.org. Are you tired of worship that's more about self-help than the Savior, the Christian rather than the Christ, and Christ in you instead of Christ for you? It's not about you, it's about Jesus for you. Find a church near you, issuesetc.org, and click Find a Church.
Christ Your Life, an Easter sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin.
Even though we die, we live. When a Christian breathes his last, no one dies. No one can die. For Christ has already died in the Christian's place.
And we'll send you a CD of this sermon and an Ascension sermon for any size gift before Easter Sunday. Make a secure online donation today. IssuesETC.org. Thanks for your support during the season of Lent.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Historic action by the House.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
On February 19th, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a continuing resolution featuring historic pro-life provisions. The most notable provision prohibits Planned Parenthood from receiving federal taxpayer funding. The bill also eliminates federal funding of organizations that perform abortions overseas, as well as the United Nations Population Fund. Finally, it ends federal funding of elective abortions in the District of Columbia. The U.S. Senate is expected to reject these provisions, but they could make it into the final version of the bill, which will likely be crafted by the conference committee of both houses.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List, inviting you to join us in our battle for life. For more, go online to sba-list.org.
In about 5 minutes, we're going to be playing Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week, playing four Issues Etc. soundbites for you. Then we need your votes live this Friday, April the 1st. Our call-in number 1-877-623-6943. Send your vote to us via email, talkback@issuesetc.org, or vote at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Soundbite of the Week in about 5 minutes. Molly Ziegler-Hemingway is our guest. Molly, you were talking about confession and the way that the press covers it. How do you think they did with the story of the Confession iPhone app that turned out to be a preparation for Confession iPhone app?
I don't know. I mean, I even thought about, there are, you know, two issues there. When I read this just local CBS story about Confession, I almost thought it assumed that the reader knew more than the reader might know about what this sacrament is like. And then on the other hand, there are just sometimes outright errors when you look at the app that helps people keep track of their sins so that they can do a better job with confession, enumerating their sins. That was covered horribly. It was making it seem like you could go to confession without actually going to confession, and you kind of wonder if the reporters covering it had even known enough about confession and how it works to report that story accurately. It certainly seemed that that was not the case.
You wrote very recently about, you said, the mini meltdown that you had when you were perusing the BBC site on the issue of these little 70 little lead books that were found and are alleged to have a connection to earliest Christianity. Why the meltdown, Molly?
Well, I didn't even realize how much I was relying on the BBC until this happened. There was an hour or two where the BBC site was down, and I realized that every story I wanted to read at that moment was a story from the BBC. Thankfully, it came back online. I don't even know what the problem was, but shows you how reliant we can get on some of these digital communications. But the story was really interesting, particularly the way it was pitched. It basically said that they had just found the earliest Christian writing in existence. It had survived 2,000 years through this amazing process in which it was kind of plugged into a cave, that it had been smuggled out of Jordan by a Bedouin who had taken it to Israel, these really amazing Christian relics. And all the quotes in the story suggested that this was maybe the most interesting or important find since the Dead Sea Scrolls, maybe more important. I mean, it was a very dramatic story, and I got very excited by it. And it's important, but the media lesson here is that the next day I was coming across this blog, Larry Hurtado, who's this very renowned early Christian writing scholar, had said, you know, that these stories were not wise. You know, it is, I guess, potentially possible that they are important. It's just as impossible that they're not even Christian. They could be Jewish writings, for all we know. And we really can't make these claims until we've done a better job of analyzing them, decoding them. I mean, some of them were allegedly in code. And so people were making all these very dramatic claims, and they were probably making those claims because they're looking for funding or they're looking for a way to get the documents back into Jordan or whatnot. So it's very important that reporters show that other side, show that there are people who are saying this might not be as dramatic as, you know, others are making it out to be. It still can be an exciting story to read, but it's just more honest when you get perspective from people who are less interested in the particular outcome of the story.
Molly, before I let you go, I just wanted to let you know that the Luther quote you provided for us earlier this week on Christianity and the value of assertions is up for Issues Etc. soundbite of the week.
Oh, great. I think, by the way, that people who win that whoever says the soundbite should win the prize for that.
Oh, really? You think that's my...
I'm just kidding.
The source of the soundbite should win the LPR bundle package.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Right. You know, it actually does make some sense, but... Jeff's shaking his head, so...
Oh, darn. Okay.
He has the final say on those.
I'll just try for another way.
Molly Ziegler-Hemingway is editor and writer in Washington, D.C., and a contributor to GetReligion.org. Molly, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you.